Welcome to Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the ArtsUS Center for the African Diaspora.
Donald Eubanks, Associate Professor at Metropolitan State University and Cultural Consultant.
And I'm Marianne Combs. I'm a reporter and producer with NPR News.
And Luz Maria Frias and Hli Lee couldn't be with us today, but we have two special guests, the authors of What God Is Honored Here, Writings on Miscarriage and Infant Loss by and for Native Women and Women of Color. This is author Shannon Gibney and Kao Kalia Yang. Welcome, y'all.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. You know, we've all read the book in preparation for today and read the stories from the book, and we're going to get into the meat of the book and have you explain the book a little bit, but I wanted to give two pieces of data just in the spirit of Luz Maria Frias, who's always doing this for us, but they really stuck out to me. In the introduction of your book, you have this part where you say, again, according to the CDC, in 2015, infant mortality rates per 1,000 live births were 11.3% for black babies, 8.3% for American Indian babies, 5% for Latinx babies, 4.9% for white babies, and 4.2% for Asian American babies. Again, following a lot of the disaggregated race data and a lot of our conversations here on Counter Stories. But this is the piece that got me. In fact, according to the CDC, a risk factor for miscarriage and stillbirth is, quote, being of the black race. And so while we're going to be talking about miscarriages, one of the things that's a carry through a lot of our conversation is the disparity that is still pervasive and present in our everyday pieces of lives, including some of the tragic moments in our lives. So can you tell us a little bit about some of your findings as you were doing the research, as you were collecting these stories in the book?
You know, for me, it started with my own experience of miscarriage. Mm-hmm. My mother had had seven. She has seven living, seven dead. I wrote about her piece, either side, mm-hmm. in the book. But I have always known that miscarriages can happen and that they can happen to good people. When it happened to me in America, it took me by surprise because my mom had experienced these things, so these are not things that we talked about frequently or often or openly, even among women. And so in the loneliness of the aftermath, I started looking for resources to comfort my heart. I went, as a writer, to the shelves that I love, literature. I found that there were none. Mm. I found that while miscarriage and infant loss happen disproportionately to Native women and women of color in this country, our voices have not been included. And so my hunger to learn more left me even more lonely than before, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the same is true for me. You know, I think you put it beautifully, Kalia, sort of we have to start with our own experience. And I had a stillbirth at 41 and a half weeks, so my daughter was 10 days late, actually. And as you can imagine, it was absolutely devastating. Obviously, it's not something you can prepare for at all. You go through an experience like that, and it's traumatic enough in its own right. And then when there's like this narrative hole, mm-hmm. right, where mm-hmm. you feel like you cannot see your experience reflected back to you.
You referred to it as a second death in your introduction. Mm-hmm. It's a mm-hmm. second tragedy mm-hmm. that you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And not just you, right? It's your whole family yeah. and your yeah. community, everyone who is there with you, going through it in their own individual and collective way. And that is an additional layer of trauma. And so, you know, your body, of course, has to heal as well as, you know, your psychological and emotional self. And so it was a few years, I think, after my loss, and I knew Kalia had been public about her loss as well. So we've been friends for a while and have been following each other's work and had always respected each other's work. And I reached out to her and was like, you know, I've been looking and I can't find anything on this topic by and for Native women and women of color. Would you like to put something together with me? And she said yes. And I mean, I think also particularly as a black woman, you know, right now, the past 2 years especially, there's just been this massive outpouring of data and first person stories mm-hmm. about this crushing disparity, right? These crushing issues that black women and black babies, black families face in this country, which has gotten worse, you know, over the past 30 years. the outcomes are just staggering. And you see in, you know, there's a bunch of women in this collection that tell their stories very powerfully. And you see the intersection of racism, sexism, classism, all these things in many of the women's experiences. Tyann Coleman in her piece talks about, you know, the miscarriage that she experienced and how she felt like her doctor didn't want to touch her, actually. And so, I mean, there's a lot, I want to say, you know, our book is not first and foremost a book about activism in this area, but I think what it does, I would say it is a call to action in many ways. And I mean, I would say that it is first and foremost a call to action to listen to the stories of women, to listen to our love for our children. And Kalia, I don't know if you want to talk about that. You've also spoken, I think, powerfully kind of connecting the dots historically on that too.
So I said yes to Shannon immediately because I knew that I wanted something like this. I needed something like this. And I knew that others did as well. But I also said to Shannon, after our childbearing years are through, because I knew that the story would be different depending on the outcomes of these years. Because I understood one thing fundamentally, you know, in this country, we've never been comfortable with the idea that women of color and Native women care deeply about our children. In the Native American example, right, you take their children away to these schools as if that love was something that you can bend and that you could break. You know, in the experience of African Americans, those of us who cared understand what happened during the slavery years, what happens right now with the prison pipeline, you know. So in the case of refugees like the Hmong, when the American soldiers came to the high mountains of Laos, they commissioned boy and girl soldiers, 7, 8, 9, and 10, to do the work that grown men won't do. You know? And that is possible because we live in a nation that has not reckoned with the fact that women of color love our children deeply.
And what's happening on the border now with Latinx parents and mothers being separated, the human rights atrocities going on there every day.
So while it isn't a direct confrontation with this fact, it speaks directly to it.
One of the patterns that we struggle to really explain for our dominant cultural audience here on Counter Stories, and that is that intersection between all of these ways of having to be, of having to tell the story, of having to engage in that. I also find in your book one of the things that finally lines up with how my home community practice, and that is story, right? Story is medicine. The ability to tell one's story and to speak to it. But even that gets problematized because when do you give your story in a way that's safe, in a space that's safe? And so that all of those things kind of come to light. And so it was courageous getting to work through this. But then all these different stories intersect on so many different levels. I'm brought to the story. I think you have a piece to read from it of a Native woman experience. And there's a section in there where you see not only the cultural space clash with the medical field, but also nods to what you just described in your history, Kalia.
Shannon, you'll read Sarah Agaton Howe's?
Yeah, Sarah Agaton Howe wrote a beautiful, devastating piece for us called Lessons from Dying, and I'm just going to read a short excerpt from that. I carried her out of the hospital. The nurses thought we were delusional. But one thing about Anishinaabeg is we follow our own sets of rules. I knew there would be no explanations, no autopsies, no funeral homes. So I wrapped her up. They wheeled me out like the quote-unquote real moms, and we drove her home. Did you know you could keep your tiny baby this way? I stared at her for 24 hours to be sure there had not been a mistake, that she wouldn't suddenly gasp for breath, that this all wasn't some cruel hoax. Nothing. There was nothing left. I had no ceremony for this. I made things up. I gave her tiny moccasins and tiny special pajamas. Her grandpa made her a tiny box. We made up prayers and rituals and poured dirt over her tiny box. And then after a person buries their tiny baby in tiny moccasins in a tiny box, they are supposed to walk away from her. I came home to a house full of baby clothes. Tiny diapers, tiny blankets, and bags of baby gifts lined the house. After that, every movement felt slow and labored. And then I realized that I had also died. I couldn't breathe. Losing your child is losing yourself. She died. I died. I didn't. I couldn't protect her. My body, what became known as the death trap, had killed her. Or maybe the air had. The water? God? Who had killed my daughter?
That story just for me in a very personal space. What to do afterwards? There's this intersection where I was able to feel connected when my wife and I experienced a miscarriage. And I didn't even call it that because I'm still trying to figure out what the terminology is. Mm-hmm. But I remember sitting in the hospital with her and somebody coming to take the baby away. And we're like, hold on, what's going on here? And their procedure was to quickly dispose of the remains of this child and, you know, as if almost to try to prevent an attachment. Mm. Or maybe that's going to be easier. You know, I can only speculate at that. The only thing we had left in that moment was to focus on how we are going to funeralize this child. And we had a full-on funeral at the church and everything. When you said earlier the second death, it seemed like there were multiple fights and moments that we had to protect the reality of the existence of a child that it was very clear the medical professionals in front of us did not see as anything more than tissue. At least that may not have been their intention, but that was the impact. Mm-hmm. And so that story just took me all the way back there to that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's part of the power of the collection is, I mean, many people have told us, especially other women, a lot of older women have been reading the collection and coming to the readings and events that we've been doing and have found it incredibly validating, but they will have that visceral experience that you're talking about. I mean, your body remembers, right? And I think that there is this way, my mother is a therapist and she talks about how we live in a grief averse culture. And she also was a nurse for 30 years, strangely enough. She helped start the bereavement program at the NICU at a University of Michigan hospitals in Ann Arbor because there was nothing there for parents who were losing their babies. And there was no recognition mm-hmm. that there was a need to grieve. And so I think that it's evolving. I definitely think that it is a lot better than it was. But this idea that somehow a baby that has not been born, right, is less of a loss than a child that's in the world mm-hmm. is deeply problematic.
Yes.
If you talk to parents, you talk to mothers, you talk to grandparents, you talk to community members, I mean, people start creating stories about that baby as soon as the baby is conceived, mm-hmm. right? And whatever you want to call it, viable, yeah. you know? And so whether or not it exists in a certain medical sense or a philosophical sense, it exists in the hearts of those families and those parents, and that needs to be honored. So like when my daughter, when I gave birth to her, you know, and my mom, again, had been through this so much working in the bereavement program at the NICU at University of Michigan Hospital. So she understood that we needed to call, you know, the hospital had a service where you can call somebody. There are professionals who what they do is take pictures of deceased babies for the parents, you know, to have those. And I am so glad that we did it. My partner is not American. He's Liberian, and they have different cultural understandings of mm-hmm. these things. And he didn't understand. He didn't want this. He thought it was morbid. And then now as the years have passed, it's been 6 years since mm-hmm. this happened, he's so glad that we have those pictures and those memories. I mean, she's in the ground now. She's at Lakewood Cemetery. But just to be able to see her face and to show those pictures to my children is so meaningful.
And I think the body remembers, you know, they could take the baby away. And there's a body of research that's emerging that whether a woman experiences a live birth or a miscarriage or infant death, that her body is changed fundamentally and forever. I remember I was 19 weeks pregnant when I had my miscarriage. And I remember about a week later, sitting on my mom and dad's toilet in their house, leaning down and feeling what I thought were tears on my legs. But I wiped up my eyes and they were dry. Looked down and it was milk. Mm. And 19 weeks, mm-hmm. you know, my body was weeping. Mm. You know, and I remember the absolute loneliness of that moment. My husband, like you, had been by my side in the hospital room. He couldn't have been there with me in that bathroom or the many moments after, you know, when my body was crying.
Listening to these stories and to the discussion, for me, personally, I was the oldest, right, supposedly, until my mother, somewhere in our youth, mentioned that first child was stillborn. So I was supposed to have an older sister. Her name was Janet. So reading this book really, for me, emotionally triggered a lot of things. One, my mother's from Mille Lacs. My mother's Anishinaabe. Moved to the city in the early 50s. Someone posted a picture on Facebook of her when she was 18 years old. She was 20 when she had me. So that meant she gave birth to my older sister when she was 19. She had just graduated from boarding school because she was part of that last generation that was sent to Flandreau, South Dakota, and Pipestone. So as I was reading these stories and then I'm listening to you talk, I don't know how my mother dealt with that because she never talked about it with us. And there was a particular story in your book that really triggered me where the woman's second child was a little girl. And the little girl would make the comment that she was the oldest. That's your story.
It's your story.
Yeah. And your comment was, yes, you're the oldest girl.
The oldest living girl.
And so that really resonated with me because it reminded me of all the times I would make the comment to our friends and relatives that I was the oldest, and I wasn't. And so it really, really, that story rocked me because I never knew what my mother's reaction was. And my mother's now at a place where I can't really have those conversations. She's still alive, but I can't have those conversations with her.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I think Shannon and I have found at our readings, they're not very popular. You know, we're both now seasoned enough writers, as Shannon likes to say. We're no longer spring chickens.
No, we're seasoned hens.
Yeah. So, yes. So when we do readings, especially at bookstores, you know, we fill the spaces. Mm-hmm. But with this book, that's been an entirely different experience. And most of the time, it's been women. But when men come or when they read the book, you know, they're triggered by so many things in it. But our contributor, Sung Yong Shin, and our dear friend, poet extraordinaire, she says that every single, you know, she reminds all of us, every single living human being on the face of this earth still comes from the womb of a born woman. Mm. Miscarriage happens to 1 out of 4 women in America. That's an estimate.
Yeah. You know, you talk about in the introduction of the book a little bit how ridiculous that is given the amount of wealth and science. I mean, you know, my sister-in-law works in the health field, and she's a midwife, and talks a little bit about, you know, in the state of Minnesota, functionally, now not everybody knows about all the offerings, but functionally you are guaranteed as a pregnant woman services that you don't ever know about, right? One of their hardest issues is folks not knowing that you have guaranteed health care, but not long enough, right? Yeah. She constantly talks about going back and reviewing and saying that that healthcare should last much longer than it does because a lot of the issues that can come about for mother and baby also continue into those years. And so, you know, it's been insightful to just get a chance to see these stories. To the point that you were getting to earlier, Kalia, you know, talking about how your husband was walking through it, I'm keenly aware that while I'm part of this, and I'm feeling a portion of this, there's a part where my physical experience stops.
Yes.
And I can only go the rest of the way in empathy, and that'll never be enough to be able to walk in solidarity with my wife. Yes. And so hearing these stories provided for me just more to add into that empathy column. I couldn't be with her in all of those specific moments. I couldn't be with her to know exactly how the body feels. So our conversations will only be able to get as close as empathy will allow in total. You know what I mean? So, but I've appreciated the stories from that perspective.
I think, you know, we find this definitely, I mean, we both write in a variety of genres, but I mean, your sort of first genre, your home genre is memoir, right? Which
yes.
The dominion of memoir in the West has been cisgender white males, mm-hmm. right? And in so many ways, it's sort of like the normalized story, right, is of the male body, the white male mm-hmm. body, et cetera. And I think it's been very interesting as, you know, the book launched October 15th during National Infant Loss Awareness Month. And so it's been out, you know, for, 3 months now. And so it's been interesting now to have the book out in the world, right? There's our own process of putting the stories together, working together, writing our stories, et cetera, et cetera. And then it becomes something else when it's out in the world and you're interacting with other people in the world around it. And so it has been very interesting, you know, at events and also I think online, we've had some interesting interactions with men where, you know, they're just like, oh my gosh, what we keep on hearing. I remember this more from men, but we have had women say this too. Yes. Like, I did not expect to resonate so deeply mm-hmm. with this book. This book is about a topic that I never thought I could connect with because I don't have any experience, direct experience with this. But, you know, our argument is like all good literature should be about the human experience. What mm-hmm. does it mean to be mm-hmm. human? And this is a key part of what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm. In our argument, I think in our respective bodies of work is that we have, as individuals and as societies, we have the most to learn from the people that we've never heard enough of.
For me, reading this book, you were talking about the universality of the experience. And as A, a white woman, but B, as a woman who has never tried to get pregnant and has never dealt with birth or child loss, there were a couple of things that really struck me. And you bring them up eloquently in the introduction, but then they're threaded throughout and become these themes throughout all the stories, which is A, racism and sexism's impact on healthy birth rates. And as a result, that these stories are actually part of a larger narrative about Indigenous and POC mm-hmm. mothers being separated mm-hmm. from their children.
Yes.
And how again and again you feel those moments of just horror because a doctor doesn't seem to want to touch the patient or because a doctor discounts the woman's pain and says, oh, just take some Tylenol. It's going to be okay. These moments which you now know were so key in the health and well-being of that woman and her child. And you said earlier in the hour that you didn't mean to write this. This is not activism. But for me, it really stoked the fires of anger and just feeling this call to action around how do we change the system? How do we bring equity to the doctor's office for women of color and women in general?
I mean, I think the first step is awareness. I mean, it's just these stories, you know, have not been heard in our own communities and then in the larger communities too, right? And if they are heard, they're, you know, reduced, their complexity is sort of, you know, into a soundbite. And, you know, we're writers, we're editors, we're people, first and foremost, that work with language, we're teachers. There are a lot of people working on this. I mean, particularly I know as, and that's not to be like to people listening, oh, you don't need to do anything. That's not what I'm saying. But I just want to give credit to like, you know, birthing justice movements, many of which are headed up by Black women mm-hmm. doing incredible work. And so the awareness piece is key. And then part of the awareness piece is good data. You know,
exactly.
There's a huge gap, right, in data. And then, of course, money that goes into research for women's health. It's paltry. It's ridiculous. So there's a lot of that. And then, of course, you know, the huge question that I know you probably talk about a lot on here is like, how do you deal with implicit bias in systems?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you effectively deal with this? Like, I don't, especially in Minnesota, like there's all these really nice, good people, right, who are perpetrating basically like racially violent acts on other people, right? And it's like at that point, it's like, I don't care if you're a good person or not. You just ran over my son or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't. So how can we deal with this? I don't know. What do you want to say about that, Kalia?
Well, I want to say we're in a state, right? If you look at Minnesota in terms of racial equity measures, we're like second worst, if mm-hmm. not the worst in the state. And yet we are not. It is not ironic to me that Shannon and I, as an African-American woman, as a Hmong woman, that we've teamed up to put this book, that in terms of a collection like this, that this is breaking new ground, and that's breaking new ground from Minnesota, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't just happen right. this way, right? What is so important, I think, in this, and yes, it's the research. You know, Anthony, you read from the statistics about Asian American women. Mm-hmm. There are no research about Asian American refugees, for example, mm-hmm. refugee populations. They don't desegregate the research that way. Mm. You know, so it was in my own life.
And for the American Indians, we're always told here in Minnesota, we're statistically
insignificant.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
I didn't even have to finish that sentence.
Exactly. Yes, because I've heard it so many times from like demographers and like whatever. What does that mean?
Exactly. And when we get these reports that show the disparities, we don't even show up.
Exactly.
Not maybe as a little byproduct in the bottom of the paragraph.
Exactly.
Even in this discussion, mm-hmm. what so much emotion and, you know, because it was just tear me apart, but it also takes me back to think about the strength of my mother, because this was in a time period where Native American children were being removed from mothers, from our families, and placed with white families. Mm-hmm. No explanations, none whatsoever, just removed.
Yes.
And after being forced to go to boarding school. So, you know, we have talked about some of these different themes in some of our other Counter Stories episodes, but I'm just amazed at how this book, without even mentioning those things, weaves all this stuff together.
Exactly. Because the fact that your mother was removed from her family and put in a boarding school, I would never have connected that story to somebody's story of a miscarriage until this book. And now to see the connections between the two is just so powerful, that this is a long narrative. This is a long tradition of removing, of tearing children from their mothers.
Oh. And I think this book is particularly important because we're not talking about the strength of our mothers or the strength of who we are as women. We are crying with our hearts on these pages, and we're weeping with each other for the world to hear. We're not afraid and we're not sorry. You know, so often as a woman of color, when I'm formally presented or I meet people, there is an expectation of my conduct. There's an expectation of the standard in which I must think or feel or act, right? This is a book that forces its readers to cry with us, mm-hmm. or at the very least hear us cry for each other mm-hmm. and for all those babies who make us who we are today.
And I think that's shocking for a lot of people. I still remember that woman that came up to us at that one reading it, a next chapter. Older woman.
Older. Yeah.
Older white woman.
Yeah.
And she said, it was so moving to me. She said, you use the word, she's dead. You use the word dead in describing your baby. She said, I never felt like I could say that. I felt like my whole life I've just been tiptoeing around the fact that the baby died. The baby, I couldn't say that to anybody in my circle, right? And just to be able, and she was like, and it's just so freeing to be able to just tell the truth, right? And to not worry about, you know, like how people might receive it and, you know, who might get offended and, oh, is it inappropriate? And I mean, so much of our lives as women is just policed, right?
Yes.
You got me chills over here because I've never said that. I've never been able to say that. Still can't. The way that you write in this book and all the stories come through in this book, one of the things I feel is missing or that has been pulled out of many of our communities. I'm going to be specific to Black and Hmong communities. We share collard greens. We share all these different things.
Yeah.
One of the things that we also share is the importance of that story and how story is used to move through the human things.
Yes.
And I think that's very important. You know, we were able to get a clip of somebody in community to describe their experience. And I want to take a listen to the clip. And I know we've got a little disclaimer to do, so I'll pass it to you, Marianne. Yeah. But I want to tie in the importance of finally being able to tell that story, because this is from somebody who hasn't really had a chance to do this, and by nature of the book, was able to finally do this.
Mm. Before we play this clip, I should note that the producer made an editorial decision not to name this person. in part because we want to encourage communities to talk freely about this issue without fear or shame, so we don't want to focus on the naming. This mother was sent home from hospital after being told the baby had no heartbeat.
So I woke up that morning. It was a Sunday morning, I think. And I woke up that morning, and my stomach just didn't feel great. And I remember talking to my mom because I was in my parents' house, and I told my mom, my stomach doesn't feel good. And I think she suggested that I go to the bathroom, and it was probably gas. And so I went into the bathroom, and I sat on the toilet, and a bunch of blood just came out. And I called my mom, and then we went to the hospital, my mom and I, and maybe my sister. It's hard to remember. And we went to the hospital, and they did an ultrasound and said, there's no heartbeat, there's no fetal heartbeat. And then they sent me home that day, actually. And if I were to think about it now, I would think that, wow, that doesn't really make sense. I wouldn't think that they would send someone home. So I ended up actually later that day delivering in my bathroom, on my bathroom floor, and the body of the fetus got stuck. And we had to call an ambulance, and I was taken to the hospital, and I honestly don't remember the rest of the day after that. I know that they did something at the hospital, and they were able to dislodge, I guess, the body of the fetus from me. We did name him. It was a boy, and we did name him. He had anencephaly, I believe is what it's called, where the brain hadn't developed correctly. And so I think that it was important for us to not just move forward as though he didn't exist. It was important for us to name him, to acknowledge that he was a person and that he existed.
There's so many pieces there that are part of the daily lived, even in the moment where you are experiencing tragedy, the things that are done to women of color, mm-hmm. that are not done in the same ways to their counterparts. Mm-hmm. The way that you're forced in your experiences to have to, I mean, just even listening to her tell that story, I listened to the laughs, I listened to the lilt and the voice. I got all the way into that clip and still realized that, as you said earlier, Shannon, she's trying to help take care of everybody around mm-hmm. as yes. she tells the story exactly. of her tragedy.
Exactly. Yes.
Like these stories make it so that we have to get real about all of those things. And so they're all still connected. Mm-hmm. And that struck me.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the important things is that in many ways that it is women who have taken care of each other mm-hmm. across time. And that right now as Native women and women of color, we have to stand by each other if the world is going to hear us at all. It's this understanding of the landscape that we are living and dying on.
Can you talk a little bit about the experience of gathering together these different voices and what you found in the process of editing and sharing these stories?
This is, I think, a project that neither of us could have done alone. You know, there are some books that you write that you don't ever want to write, and this is one of those books. I think Shannon and I, if somebody had asked us, would you one day like to put together a book about miscarriage and infant loss, buying for Native women and women of color? Short answer, no. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not a story that any writer yearns to write. But when we found ourselves in those situations so hungry for a voice, so hungry for words, we knew that it was necessary and needed. We put forth a call, and Women's Press has done a superb job of amplifying our voices across the state, definitely, and then online in whichever and however many ways they can. Shannon and I, we both have formed, because we're now seasoned chickens, different networks across the country. You know, I did my training in New York. Shannon did hers in Pittsburgh. We've both been in Minnesota for all time. And so we called forth from these networks that we've fostered through our all of our years of going to school and becoming. And that's what we needed to pull it together. We put forth a call, and within 2 months, we had more than enough.
We got and really great pieces in terms of the writing. I mean, that was one thing that we were very clear on. We wanted to make sure that the collection really pierced people and got to kind of like the heart of the experience. And for that, you need good writing. I mean, a lot of what I remember encountering right after my experience was like a lot of, you know, language. If people were writing about it, it was like, oh, my angel, and, you know, my heart, and like just a lot of stuff that it's just language that is very kind of overused and flat, and it doesn't have specificity. And so there were some pieces by writers who, you know, this was an experience that happened to them, but this was one of maybe the first pieces that they tried to write. And definitely we had to do, you know, some editing and deep revisions with those folks. But the majority of folks are seasoned writers in this collection. I think the really hard part, it was difficult. We've had people say to us, oh my gosh, how did you sift through all those stories of loss? And I mean, that was part of the reason why, you know, when the idea for this came to me, I knew there was no way that I could do it by myself. I knew I needed somebody who had really good writing chops, but also had like this deep heart, you know? So I was just like so lucky, you know, that Kalia wanted to work with me. And it's been a difficult process of putting the stories together, but it's also been an incredibly beautiful and healing process, I think, for us as well. You know, we were friends before, but it was more sort of like colleagues, and now we're dear friends, you know? And
Shannon said this, we don't see many popular images of an Asian American woman and an African American woman working side by side the way we have. It's a model of working that simply isn't out there when you're thinking about it. Mm-hmm.
What do you think prevents that?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my.
So many things,
you know, right? Because, but this is a recurring topic that we touch here.
It is.
And one of the classes I teach at Metro is called Comparative Racial and Ethnic Analysis.
Yes.
In that class, however, you know, we are talking about the experiences of African-American, Native American, Asian American, and then Latinos and Hispanic. I often emphasize to our class, because we have a lot of students of color and immigrant students in our classroom. It's a social work program that I'm a part of. But I'm always commenting how we're learning about these experiences that we've had here in this country. I remind them that there isn't a lot of cross-cultural or cross-communication going on between our different various communities.
That is such an important question. I'll come at it this way, Don, and it isn't to sidestep the question at all. You know, when Shannon and I first put forth the call, we got so much pushback from white folk. Why are you eliminating our stories? You know, even right up to the night of the launch on the public site, a man on Facebook whose profile was a gun posted on the comment, why are you erasing white women's stories, right? As editors, one of the entries that we turned down was from a man. He'd written a poem, and it was just a bad fit and a bad poem, frankly. Mm-hmm. But we wrote, you know, very graciously back that it wasn't a good fit. And he said back,
was it a white male?
Yes, an educated white man with a PhD who teaches at a major institution. He said, who wants to be a part of your stupid collection anyway? With a name like that, you know, Shannon was so mad, and I said to Shannon, "No, don't respond.
We're she not, knows
we're
me.
Not, we're but, not going to engage."
So, but even
I'm gonna get there. You know, and the thing was, you know, I understood from the same place that she did, but I grew up on the poor side of St. Paul, the east side of St. Paul. My first runs, you know, in the housing projects were first African American children. By the time the Hmong came, white folk had left. It was poor black folk and then these new refugees, you know. So they were my first friends, but also the first people I fought with, right? On the east side of St. Paul, we played with each other on the streets, but they were also the first ones to break into our homes and vice versa, right? We were all so fraught and stretched with trying to survive. Growing up, I thought to myself, one day I'm going to get a college education. I'm going to get a job and I'm going to move everybody I love out of this neighborhood. I'm never coming back. Then you grow up. And you know what you discover? That who you have become is not such a bad example of a human being. That my dad was right all along, that the poverty of our lives had nothing to do with the wealth we carried in our hearts. And so I moved my family back to the neighborhood that raised me. And I think this is true. My first friend was an African-American girl who wanted to touch my hair, and I wanted to touch her hair, you know. And Shannon and I, we come together in this place motivated by all of the same pressures of the America that we all live under, understanding that we stand together or we all die. Mm-hmm. But I think it takes a kind of emotional and intellectual maturity. And also, very plainly, the privileges of sitting and thinking and creating yes. stories together mm-hmm. and listening to each other's stories, right? When Shannon teaches my books in her classes regularly, and I've been visiting for over a decade now.
And you're going to come this, I'm about to send you an email to come out.
Yes, but her African-American students and her Native students are always like, I didn't know that the Hmong had gone through so much. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that your being here had something to do with America to begin with, because we're newcomers, you know? So there is a lot of education that we need to do between each other and across groups in order to foster the kind of bond that makes a project like this possible.
And I want to just say, if I can also say, that I think what I always find with between historically marginalized communities, right, whether it's Hmong and African Americans, yeah. whether it's African Americans and African immigrants, yeah. whether it's Native Americans and Latinx folks, yeah. or, you know, et cetera, it's like we have to go through whiteness to get to each other, mm. right? Yes. And so whiteness, it's like, it's two choices. Yeah. All this misinformation, right?
Or none or nothing. At all. Exactly.
Not just silence,
exactly.
right? And so, I mean, I know both of us have worked in institutions, mm-hmm. right? I work in an institution right now. And it's like, I mean, just to get, I work at a two-year college, just to get our African diaspora studies program, right? I've worked there for like, whatever, many years now, 12 years now. Yes. I mean, it's a battle, right? Yeah. It was a battle. And then, of course, then to have teachers, right? And I don't want to be monolithic here, just because you're a teacher of color, a woman of color, that does not mean that you're going to have like a liberatory pedagogy, that you're going to actually teach, you know, curriculum that speaks to the breadth and depth of America. But certainly it's more likely that that will happen if you inhabit that identity. And I mean, all the Black woman faculty that I know at my institution are trying to get out because it's just so hostile to us. So, I mean, these are deeply structural mm-hmm. questions we tend to make personal because we don't know how else to talk about it. It just becomes too big.
But there's also the wearing down of having to defend why focus on folks of color. One of your examples, you reference a 2004 study published in the American Journal of Public Health, which comes to a conclusion that it turned out, this is your quote from that study, it turned out that as a predictor of very low birth weight outcome, these racial discrimination questions were more powerful than asking a woman whether or not she smoked cigarettes.
Yeah, that yes. was devastating wow. to read. Yeah. And I think also mm-hmm. it's been devastating for me as a very privileged, economically privileged, light skin, identify as mixed Black woman. You know, I've got
found the fountain of youth.
Except for if you look at my hair, but that's another thing. So, you know, we go back and forth on this. But, you know, it was devastating, too, when you read that research to find out that the class buffer is no buffer, actually, for Black women.
Right.
You know, being an educated, economically privileged Black woman actually is more risky for you in terms of your maternal health than being lower income, less educated.
How does that work?
Yeah.
A lot of people yeah. have theories about it. My theory is that I don't know if you've read. Also, Tressie McMillan Cotman has an essay in her collection Thick, right, where mm-hmm. she talks about mm-hmm. her experience with a miscarriage. It's horrible, mm-hmm. right? So it's like all these white woman nurses and white male doctors mostly not listening to her. She had this pain in her gut and they were just like, "Oh, just take some Tylenol," all this stuff, and kind of one of the main things that I got from that was like the more she advocated or tried to advocate for herself, the more they were like, this woman doesn't know what she's talking yeah, about.
Exactly.
And so we're going to have mm-hmm. to put her in her place. Mm-hmm. And I think so many of us educated Black women who work in institutions and also then navigate institutions and healthcare and everything else, we understand exactly what that is. It's sort of like, how dare you have this kind of body and assume that you have any kind of agency whatsoever in it and could possibly have any relevant information to your own health or the health of your baby.
In hearing what you just said there, so that means I can't advocate full out. But in as the clip that we played showcase, I also get taken advantage of by not knowing what to advocate for. So you get sent home to have to experience this on your bathroom floor. Again, too many times in counter stories, we encounter this you're damned if you do, damned if you don't space, and there's no intersection space, which it boggles my mind. And then at the same time, while you're doing all of that, still have to defend why focus on the prevalent data that's clear in the room while still having to deal with how you're going to present it, while being told how you have to present it. And all of a sudden, that stress ball that you described really starts to build up.
Yeah.
Really starts to build up.
I mean, as Catherine Squires, one of our contributors, says, right, if this happens to Beyonce and one of the Williams sisters, Serena Williams, what chance do the rest of us have, right? What chance do the rest of us have?
You know, it's been so great. And we have to keep this conversation going more. But I've just gotten into the practice of quoting the babies in my center since you brought us to diasporic pedagogy. One of the students, in preparation for coming here, talked about losing their child, she got a copy of the book.
Oh, thank you.
She had this to say to you. When you can fight in all these ways and nothing seems to ever work, your stories replace the guns. They become the swords that give us freedom. Thank you so much for being able to write and curate the stories that become the swords that give us freedom. This has been Counter Stories. I'm Anthony Galloway.
Don Eubanks.
Marianne Combs.
Shannon Gibney.
Kalkalia Yang.
Thank you. We'll see you next time.